his way home from the G20 summit after a trade war ceasefire with China, President Donald Trump was optimistic.
If it happens, it goes down as one of the largest deals ever made.
However, on Monday, China was more cautious, with state media describing it as more of a truce. One of the few details came from a Trump tweet on Monday. He says China will reduce and remove tariffs on U.S. cars.
The head of the Roman Catholic Church has issued his clearest warning yet regarding homosexuality and its priests and nuns. Don't act on it or get out. Pope Francis says he doesn't want them to live a double life and reminds that all clergy, gay or not, take a vow of celibacy when they sign up.
General Motors is shutting down 5 factories in North America and laying off 14,000 workers, underscoring a long-standing issue facing automakers. Americans are not buying cars like they used to. Why? For starters, there's been a lifestyle shift. More people are moving and living in cities than ever before and are relying on public transportation. There are also those who want to live an environmentally friendly lifestyle, which is partially fueling the bike sharing craze that has popped up in urban centers around the country. And then there is the cost. Saddled by high student loan debt, some millennials say they can't afford a monthly car payment. They opt for on-demand ride-hailing services like Uber and Lyft.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's December 4th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for being with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. And we put together a really good broadcast for you today. Lots of different types of communicators in your office, I bet. And there's a different way to talk to each of them, or at least an effective way to talk to each of them. Our first guest this morning will help us learn a little bit about this. Mark Murphy, CEO of Leadership IQ and a New York Times bestselling author, will be with us. A little bit later in the program, Danielle Hale will be here, a chief economist at Realtor.com. Where does Chicago fit in the 2019 housing forecast? It is concerning news, and we'll delve into that coming up at about 5:40 this morning. But first, here on the first part of the Opening Bell with the markets on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, the Opening Bell expected to ring later this morning after markets surged yesterday on news that President Trump and the President of China had agreed to a 90-day ceasefire in the trade war. The U.S. had levied a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of goods. If after 90 days, that could go up to about 25%. It is that part of that equation that has been delayed. On the tech front yesterday, Amazon rose more than 4%. Apple jumped more than 2%. At the closing bell, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 288 points, and the NASDAQ gained about 111 points. This morning, giving some of that back, the futures market in the red. Futures on the Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ are off almost a third to a half a percent this morning. Investors starting to question whether or not the truce, or at least the seemingly first part of an agreement, is really that with China. Investors are a little nervous about that this morning. In Europe, markets are generally lower, with the FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC all off a half a percent to three quarters. And in Asia this morning, markets are mixed, with the Nikkei ending the day down about 2.5%, nearly 538 points. The Shanghai is higher by about a half a percent, the Hang Seng up by about a quarter. And oil is trading at $54.06 a barrel. Couple of stories before we begin this morning. The White House wants to end subsidies for electric cars and renewable energy sources. The White House economic advisor says the Trump administration is seeking to end tax credits for consumers who buy plug-in electric vehicles, including those made by General Motors. The tax credits typically run from $2,500 to $7,500. The comments come after Larry Kudlow, the advisor, was asked about plans following GM's announcement of U.S. plant closures and layoffs last week. He noted that ending the subsidies is a matter of policy and will happen in the near future. It feels like a little bit of retribution for General Motors in making those plant cuts and also some staff cuts. German auto executives will meet today with top Trump administration officials to talk about expansion of German auto plants in the U.S. top executives with Volkswagen, Daimler-Benz, and BMW will talk with the White House, including the Commerce Secretary and the U.S. Trade Representative. Carmakers are concerned about Trump's threats to impose tariffs on European-made cars. The administration hopes the carmakers will continue to invest directly in the U.S. and use North America for their content. We begin front and center this morning with office communications. If your office is like most, there are four types of communicators, and there's a way to talk to each of them if you want them to respond well. Mark Murphy is with us this morning of Leadership IQ. He's the CEO there, also a best-selling author on this and other issues. Mark, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Well, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
We saw the piece recently with you talking about this, and it seems to be true. I mean, we kind of went around our office seeing if we have some of these types, and I bet you people listening this morning do as well. Give us a sense of what those types of people are, those types of communicators are, and why it's important to have this conversation.
So the four big types are the analytical communicator. So this is the person that likes data, likes numbers. They like things with decimal points. Do not say to this person, well, I have a good feeling about the budget next year, because they're not hearing that. All they hear is womp, 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 womp. It's the personal communicator who likes the feeling. They are, if you think of the analytical, they might be more IQ. The feeling, the personal communicator with the feelings, they're more of the EQ. How are people reacting? What's their sense about things? Are people getting along? Then you have your functional communicator, which is your process person. This is, they want to go A, then B, then C, then D, then E, then F, and then G, and then H. And if that's bugging you, my little alphabet exercise, then you might be an intuitive communicator, which is the person that wants to get right to Z. They're the person that says, I swear, if you bring me A through all the way to Y, my head is going to explode. Just give me Z. I don't have patience for anything else. I just want the bottom line. And the reason this is interesting is that if you're trying to present to somebody, you go into your boss, and your boss is a very intuitive communicator. They just want Z. And you go in, and you're a functional communicator, and you want to give them A through Y. Odds are they will have completely tuned you out in the first 20 to 30 seconds, and then they completely miss the point that you were trying to make to them.
You've done a lot of research on this. As a matter of fact, you're right now reviewing, 180,000 different responses that you've been researching on this, so you're getting a lot of feedback from people. That in itself is a pretty big sample size.
Oh, it's huge. And the thing that it's enabled us to do is to really suss out why there are, you know, there's the old cliches about, well, you know, marketing and IT, they don't get along that well, and HR and operations, and they don't get along that well. And one of the things that we've actually discovered is that if you work in any technology, IT-related areas, that you are about twice as likely to be an analytical communicator compared with, say, people in marketing or PR or social media. They're twice as likely to be a personal communicator. And so one of the things that causes some of these breakdowns inside the company is that the IT person might walk in and say, well, let me tell you about our network utilization, and it's up 7.8%. And the marketing team is going, yeah, but how do people feel about that? Should we be excited about that? Should we be sad about that? And part of the reason we have these problems in companies is that people are literally speaking different languages to one another.
And that brings up the next part I'd like to ask you about is, if, first of all, you know, identifying all of these different communicators might be difficult depending on your office, but how do we change the way that we communicate? So if I'm generally an intuitive communicator, how can I talk to the analytical communicator or the personal communicator? What are the first steps to sort of getting a handle on that and smoothing out the communication?
Well, and that's the rub, right? That's the heart of this whole issue, is how do we change? And, you know, it's funny. I do some work with the United Nations, and I'll be in a room of people that they may speak French, and then they instantly flip to German, and then they instantly hop into Spanish. And we watch these people who can literally speak different languages all day long. They may have 5, 10 different languages. And in most of the U.S., we really just need 4. So one of the first things we need to do is whenever you're going into speak to somebody and you're talking about a topic that you need to bring them up to speed on, is just get in the habit of asking them, what's the one thing I can share with you? What's the one question you would like answered from me? We have 5 minutes together. What's the one thing that I can provide you that would be of value? If you begin with that question, then 9 times out of 10, what ends up happening is that person will tell you exactly what kind of communication they want. So if I say, well, you know, listen, I want to bring you up to speed on the Acme project. What's the one thing you want to know about this? And they say, well, I want to know, are people getting excited about this? Are people nervous about this project? Ah, well, I hear that they're using feeling language, so this tells me that they're a personal communicator. So what I need to do is I need to shut up, essentially. I need to stop whatever my natural tendency is and just speak to them in the language they want. If I go in and I say, what's the one thing you want to know? And they say, just give me the bottom line. Just cut to the chase. Well, I know they're probably an intuitive communicator, which means even though I had 20 pages of process documentation I wanted to give them, well, I'm going to have to back off on that, and I'm going to have to give them the thing that they want. If they say, well, I want to know exactly where we are on the budget, tell me how you came up with these numbers. If I hear them using number kind of language, a very technical language, I know they're probably an analytical, which means I want to not use the F word. And, you know, not that one, the dirty one,
yeah, right.
Feel. I don't want to go in and use feeling language with them. And then if they say, well, I want to know where we are in the timeline. Do you have a Gantt chart? Well, this tells me they're that functional communicator. They're the process person, and I need to give them what they want. And it's no different than if I went in and I said hello to somebody, and they said bonjour. And I said, well, okay, they're speaking French. I better speak to them in French.
We're speaking this morning with Mark Murphy, CEO of Leadership IQ, a New York Times bestselling author, about office communication. Mark, it feels like bosses are just throwing us all together and expecting each of us different communicators to hash it out. Are they really getting the most bang for their buck? How is all of this communicating or not communicating impacting productivity?
Well, it becomes, if you look at where people waste a huge amount of time, think about meetings. So we've all been in, you know, meetings that were just train wrecks and thoroughly painful. And one of the reasons is that we can spend half our time in a meeting just trying to get our message understood. And the problem becomes that a lot of people have the idea that if you haven't understood me yet, I just need to talk more. Maybe I need to talk louder. It's like watching somebody see a tourist who doesn't speak English, and they go, well, if I just talk louder in English, you'll understand it. And the reality is that if we all just took one step back and asked a question, what can I share with you? What's the one thing you actually want to hear? We could actually save, you know, 15, 20 minutes out of a meeting, which I know doesn't sound earth-shattering, but if you start saving 10, 15, 20 minutes out of every meeting you're in because you just ask, what's the one thing I can share with you that would get you to understand this thing that I'm talking about? Well, now, all of a sudden, this adds up to hours across a week, and that starts to become real time. And to your point, most leaders don't do a great job of understanding that, you know what, maybe the issue is me. Maybe I'm just not speaking the right language, and if I could take a step back and do that, yeah, you know what, people might actually understand what I'm talking about.
Talk to us a little bit more about your work with Leadership IQ. I know this is just one of the different areas that you've been examining. What do you hope to accomplish by your research? What other things have you been looking at?
So the big thing that we want to do is show people what great leaders do differently from everybody else. And that's really the crux of all of our research, is trying to figure out what are the aspects that make great leaders so much more effective so that we can avoid some of the missteps. You know, if we look at even famous companies, they make missteps all day long. Famous CEOs make missteps. And how much shareholder value gets eroded because a CEO makes some stupid tweet. late or sends out a memo that shouldn't have been sent out? How many CEOs have gotten fired because of things like that? And we look at this and say, if we could just all take a step back, model some of the better practices, then we might actually have a workplace that isn't quite so painful to drive to in the morning.
Mark, we appreciate you sharing some of this with us this morning. People can go where to find out more and read what to find out more about you and your work.
If you go to leadershipiq.com and go to our website and go to the right-hand side, there's a tab that says quizzes and research, and there's about a dozen free quizzes that anybody can take with your leadership style, your communication style. You can find out how you respond to giving feedback, how you respond to taking feedback, all sorts of great things to help you continue your journey to become a great leader or a great individual contributor.
Great. Thank you. Come back and join us, please.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Mark Murphy, CEO of Leadership IQ, New York Times bestselling author. Again, the website is leadershipiq.com. You can also read Mark's work on Forbes, at CNBC, and other places as well. Mark Murphy from Leadership IQ.
Hi, this is Katherine Davis from Chicago Inno with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know. New Chicago startup Voyant is working to simplify how women are tested for pregnancy at the hospital. The medical startup has created a smart toilet that administers pregnancy tests in about 5 minutes. The goal is to get test results faster and cut down on time spent in the ER. And Chicago-based battery technology company Cynode Systems is using a new $4.5 million investment from Tokyo-based chemical company JNC to relaunch its company under the name Nanograph. JNC will jointly own Nanograph and help the company commercialize its lithium-ion battery tech. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at chicagoinno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. The 2019 housing forecast is out, and the headline is Tougher Road Ahead for Home Buyers and Sellers. Let's bring in Danielle Hale this morning, Chief Economist at Realtor.com, to go over some more of the findings from the latest forecast for housing for the coming year. Danielle, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're welcome. Did I get the headline right there about what's coming in 2019?
Yes, there are some positives, but on the balance, it's going to be a tougher year for both buyers and sellers. And you might think, well, how is that possible? So for buyers nationwide, we're expecting an increase in inventory, which is good news for them. That's the bright spot. But on the flip side, we're expecting prices to continue rising in most markets, and mortgage rates are going to go up. So in most places, we're expecting homes to be a little bit more expensive. And so even though buyers will have more options, that's going to be outweighed by the fact that homes are going to be more expensive, and affordability is already a challenge in a lot of markets. And for sellers, more inventory, or prices are going to continue to rise, so that's a good thing for them. But the fact that they're going to see more inventory means more competition for them. So sellers in the past years haven't had to think about competition at all. They list a home, it sells quickly for at or above asking price. They may even get multiple offers. But that's not necessarily going to be the case in 2019. It's still not a bad time to be a seller. It just means they're going to have to think a little bit more about competition. They may not be the only home listed for sale in their neighborhood.
There are some headlines as we dig into the details of this. Mortgage rates is going to be a big thing that people look at. And then also we'll look at who is doing the buying and selling. Millennials are going to become a force here. They have started to do that, but 2019 and 2020 especially will be a big years for millennials.
Yeah, that's right. So the biggest single-year group of millennials turns 30 in the year 2020, so it's not too far away at this point. And 30 is a really key year for getting into the housing market. The National Association of Realtors has been doing surveys for over 30 years, and they find that 30 is often when people buy their first home. The median age has, drifted a year or two from that. So I think we're going to see a lot of millennials in the market at that first-time buyer age. But at the same time, the oldest millennials are now in their mid to late 30s, and so they are not first-time buyers at this point. They're in the housing market because they're trading up, because they're extending their families or seeing their life situation change in such a way that they need to trade up and get a bigger home. So we're starting to see activity for millennials on both sides. That's why they're going to be a bigger share of the housing market moving forward.
How important is the mortgage rate component here? The report says 5.3% average rate through the year, reaching possibly 5.5% for a 30-year fix by the year end.
Yeah, mortgage rates are a big concern, especially for first-time buyers. So they tend to borrow the most money. They don't have the benefit of bringing in equity from a previous home purchase. So they're really starting fresh and taking on a large amount of debt in order to become a homeowner. So mortgage rates are really important for them. And right now, mortgage rates, depending on the measure you're using, are in the 4.8 to 5% range. So we're expecting roughly a half a percentage point increase between now and the end of next year. And so on average, we'll see 5.3%. So every time the mortgage rates increase, that makes the cost of borrowing for a home that much more expensive. On balance next year, we're expecting between price increases and mortgage rate increases, nationally we expect the cost of financing a home to go up 8%. So that's a little bit of a challenge when incomes are rising in the 2 to 3% range.
And what does that do to the larger economy? And the reason we focus on this is because it's a big impact, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, everyone needs a place to live somewhere, whether you're owning or renting. And when people make that transition from renting into home ownership, they tend to buy a lot of other things. There's, you know, costs associated with moving that creates a lot of economic activity that's good for the overall economy. Now, the fact that we've had a strong jobs market now for the last several years has been a real positive for the housing market. But I think that's, you know, that's driven up prices, and that means it's likely that we're going to see that price growth slow and also sales growth slow. So that's really the big part of our forecast for 2019.
The forecast also includes a prediction of a 64.6% home ownership rate. Give us a sense of where that fits into history and how significant that is.
Yeah, so I think the 64.6%, it's a slight improvement over what we have this year. It's interesting to note that in spite of the fact that the housing market has been really challenging for first-time homebuyers right now with rising prices and rising mortgage rates, we're still seeing people become homeowners. So the homeownership rate has still been rising. The homeownership rate has ranged from an all-time low of just under 63% to that we actually hit in late 2016, to a high of roughly 69%. So it's a pretty, big or narrow range depending on your outlook. So we're now at the lower end of the range, but getting back closer to what people would consider long-term normal for the housing, for the home ownership rate.
The report is at realtor.com, and there's a list there, market by market, of what the forecast is. Chicago, we'll see, it looks like a sales growth decline of nearly 7.5%, a price growth decline of nearly 2%. Those are pretty big numbers.
Yeah, so Chicago is not one of our top markets for the forecast this year. That has to do with slower population growth in the Chicago market than we see in other markets across the U.S., somewhat slower job growth, and also slower income growth. That said, a lot of the challenges that we've highlighted for buyers nationwide are not going to be as persistent in Chicago. So rising prices are a challenge for home buyers, but in the Chicago market, with the prices expected to slip a little bit next year, that will create an opportunity, which will be good news for first-time home buyers.
As we look around the rest of the country, where's the best place to be where this forecast is concerned?
So we see a lot of smaller markets that are in our top markets, but also some larger markets as well. But typically, the commonalities in those top markets are growing metro areas, especially when it comes to population growth, and especially among those younger age groups, the millennials. So areas like Lakeland, Florida, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Chattanooga, Tennessee, and also larger markets like Boston and Miami are poised for growth in 2019.
Any concerns, any wild cards in the mix here? I know a lot of people are still talking about the tax plan, the tax law, and what kind of impact that's going to have on the housing market. What have we seen this year, and what does the forecast call for next year?
Yeah, so I think this year a lot of homeowners are trying to understand the reality of the tax plan, and I think it's really going to hit home when they do their taxes. So the plan was passed in late 2017. It's been in effect for all of 2018, but most people haven't actually done their taxes for 2018. They'll do that in early 2019, and I think that's when they're going to see, you know, will I continue to be an itemizer under this new tax plan? Does that mean my taxes are going to go up or down? And if I'm no longer itemizing, you know, I'm not necessarily getting any benefits from owning my home, maybe I want to switch and become a renter. I don't think most people are going to make that decision because people own homes for lots of reasons other than taxes. But you will on the margin see some high-income renters who had been itemizers who may no longer feel as much pressure to get into the housing market as quickly because they don't have that tax benefit from being able to itemize, in large part because a higher standard deduction will mean they just won't pass the threshold for itemizing.
And is it keeping people on the sidelines, and will we see that perhaps grow next year? And when I say sidelines, I mean does it keep them as renters and not even bother getting into the housing market?
It could be having a small effect, but I think at this point, I think the bigger effect is just the overall affordability level of housing. So that's really been what I think has caused the slowdown so far in 2018 that we've seen in home sales. Home prices are still growing, but they also have slowed, and I think next year is when we'll see the biggest impact from the tax plan as far as what people understand it and know how it affects their bottom line. This year, I think there may be some uncertainty around it that's contributing to the slowdown, but I don't think it's the big driver of the slowdown that we've seen so far in 2018.
Danielle, this is good information. We appreciate you being with us and sharing with us this morning.
Yeah, of course. It was my pleasure.
Danielle Hale is a chief economist at Realtor.com. We'll link out to the 2019 housing forecast, but you can find it at Realtor.com, the 2019 national housing forecast.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a weak open on Wall Street, with Dow futures off of nearly 0.5% now, NASDAQ futures off more than 0.5%, S&P futures off more than a third. Investors this morning now a little bit leery of whether or not there's a real China trade deal or even some progress being made there. So we're seeing a little bit of a negative concern among investors on that. Let's get a little update now on agriculture and commodities. And good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. We're still trying to determine exactly what will happen following the truce called and the trade war between China and the United States. Sonny Perdue said, however, it has yet to be determined whether China will remove tariffs on imports of American soybeans as part of that trade truce. His comments about near-term Chinese soy purchases conflict with the assessments of major U.S. trading houses, which have said China may not need to buy U.S. soybeans before South American harvests on its next crop will begin, possibly in late December. But the market did react in grain yesterday, with the screen being completely green. The March wheat contract up 3.5 cents a bushel, December corn up 4.25, and January soybeans up 10 cents. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk for this Tuesday, December 4th. On the calendar today, motor vehicle sales for November are due out. Auto industry analysts forecasting sales coming in at an annual rate of about 17.2 million units. That would be down about 300,000 from October's rate. Car makers will release their sales figures throughout the day. We'll also get a look at the Red Book, and also John Williams, one of the Fed speakers, out today. Earnings, Bank of Montreal, Dollar General, and Restoration Hardware, among those companies reporting quarterly financial earnings.